Sutta for today, the Dvaita Vitakka Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 19. And as you can see, another let's say that has a parallel in the Madhyama Agama. And this particular sutta deals with the Buddha's distinction before his enlightenment of the kinds of thoughts into wholesome and unwholesome thoughts. So this is one of those suttas that follows on, if you like, in a little bit of a theme from the Madhubhimika Sutta, which dealt with the, if you like, the existential or the kind of the deep psychological roots of thought and the way that thought can overwhelm us.
Which sutta is that you're referring to?
The Madhupindika Sutta.
Which one?
Majjhima 18.
18.
Yeah. So that one focuses more on the nature of thought, the nature of the mind, and so on. This one is a much more practical one, focusing on a way of dealing with the mind. And is very, in a sense, very one of those very modern suttas, which teaches those things which we kind of expect Buddhism to be teaching us. Basically, it's a kind of a lesson in what today would be called, what do you call it, cognitive behavioral therapy or something like that, the power of positive thinking. So if the Buddha was to flog this on the market today, he could go around, he could like do an Anthony Robbins, and go around and, you know, put ads on late night television and so on and so forth, and announcing his particular method. Because of course all of those things have been ripped off from Buddhism, but we're so nice that we don't try to claim copyright back from them. Maybe we should.
Well, you should at least announce it.
I just did.
Yes, I know, but you know, to people in the street.
Just big banners.
So, Anthony Robbins ripped off Buddhism.
Well, that's an interpretation anyway. Yeah, but generally speaking, that whole kind of emphasis, modern emphasis on, you know, the power of positive thinking and all of these kinds of things is very strongly influenced by the Buddhist perspective. And so this is what, when we turn to the Pali Canon, it's in a sense what we expect. And certainly the impression created by the Western interpreters of Buddhism has been that that's the kind of thing that Buddhism is. Buddhism's a rational psychological religion, not even a religion, rational psychological method or way of life or something, and it's about giving us practical tools with which to improve our states of mind. And this has actually become something which has become quite controversial in recent years, because even though of course we do find suttas like this one which are exactly that, then of course we find many suttas that, or supposedly we find many suttas that teach something else, according to certain scholars, and so there's a bit of a controversy about this. But in any case, this is certainly the kind of thing that most of us are interested in Buddhism, and learning about our thoughts, how to train them, and what we can do about them. And so the suttas still give us very deep and very useful advice on that. So a particular discourse set in Sarvati. Now the Chinese also is set at Sarvati, which is good. That means we don't have to have discussion about the Sarvati redaction normalization principle. It says, Pubbeva me bhikkhave sambodha, before, Pubba, eva, right before my sambodha, full awakening, anabhi sambuddhasa bodhisatta seva sato etadahosi. So when I was just a, see, the thing eva here implies just or only a bodhisattva, an unenlightened, anabhisambuddhasa bodhisattasa, an unenlightened bodhisattva. So this is one of those suttas, and again, it's very characteristic of the Pali suttas, is talking about the Buddha, or the Siddhartha Gautama, in his life before he's ordained, and it's always this kind of thing that he's teaching, and he's not typically giving stories about all the miracles he can do and all of the psychic stuff he can do and all the kind of the legends and so on, but he's telling about his very real and very down-to-earth struggles with his own mind. And so he's not concerned, as the later traditions were, to distinguish and to raise up the Bodhisattva and treat the Bodhisattva as if it's almost he's almost a completely different kind of being. Rather, he's very concerned to present himself as being an ordinary practitioner who's precisely what he's doing is not giving this in order to make people be awe-inspired or amazed by what he was as a Bodhisattva. He's doing it in order to give people some very practical advice of the problems that he had as a Bodhisattva, which are the same as the kind of problems which they're likely to face. And indeed, when we have a look at the sutta, we'll see that this is very true. It's exactly the kind of we face in our meditation. So this, of course, is very, I think, very interesting, the way these things change. And it's also interesting that the traditions are not consistent about this particular point. So here's a little footnote by Venerable Analio here. Yeah, no, it's a good footnote. I'm very jealous of him that he can put notes like this.
A footnote.
Yeah. So
you spend the rest of your life undoing things in here. Up all that other stuff.
Yeah, you probably would do. So, Thich Minh Chao, which is the book on the Majjhima Agama and Parliament Nikaya's Majjhima Agama, which I have here occasionally, draws attention to the fact that Majjhima Agama 102, just as other discourses in the Majjhima Agama, does not use the term Bodhisattva when referring to the Buddha before his awakening, while the same statement in the Pali discourses regularly includes the expression being a Bodhisattva, Bodhisattva Samano, etc., such and such references. Minh Chao's conclusion that this expression could be a later introduction by the Theravada tradition, however, does not receive support from the other agamas, since the corresponding term Pusa occurs as an expression used to refer to the Buddha's pre-awakening experiences in Virga Agama of the Dharmaguptaka school, Sanyukta Agama of the Sarvasivadin school, Ekotara Agama of the supposed Mahasangika school. Very good. So, this is the problem, that we have this Pali text, we have the Sarvastivada text, the Chinese translation, both very similar, except one uses Bodhisattva and the other one refers to him as a Buddha. Okay? And that's rather consistent, it's not just occasional, so what's the reason? So Thich Minh Chao has proposed a suggestion, but whether that's the correct suggestion or not is up for grabs, and of course this is kind of reminding us to be very cautious about the kinds of theses that we might make, historical theses about the differences between the different scriptures, because we only have parts and fragments of the particular scriptures, and so it's difficult to know what to make of these kinds of differences. He goes on to say, Sanskrit fragments of the Mahavadana Sutta, which is in Pali in the Diga, similarly use the Buddha Bodhisattva to refer to the pre-awakening experience of the Buddha Vipassi, and then giving various references to the Mahavadana Sutta, also to the Mahaparinirvana Sutta. And, okay, so these ones, these Sanskrit fragments are very likely...
What school?
Sorry?
What school?
Yeah.
Don't know.
No, we do. Yeah. Any guesses?
What Nikaya is it?
It's not in the Nikaya, it's just a fragment. Okay. Anyway, then very likely to be Sarvastivadin, or from the Sarvastivadin group of schools. Okay? More Sarvastivada or Sautrantika or Vaibhashika or Darshantika or something like that.
Who's Buddha Vipassi?
He's one of the past Buddhas. His story is told in the Mahavadana Sutta.
Do we have those sort of stories about all the other Buddhas? Is that a common thing?
No, well, actually, in the Nikayas and Agamas themselves, we only really have the Mahavadana Sutta. It's the only one that gives in any detail. In some of the later works, then yes, it does give a lot of details. So it'll give, you know, say, our Buddha went forth on a horse, and so that gives the classification. Some go forth on a horse, some on an elephant, some on foot, and some go forth by means of their palace.
Their what?
Palace.
The whole palace is kind of
goes forward. The whole palace flies up in the air and off into the jungle and then down, and that's how they go forth. So these are, and it goes through all these different things and the different classifications anyway.
But there's something to say to Nikaya.
Yeah. There's some references to the other Buddhas, for sure, yeah. References to them, but not a lot of stories about them, yeah. There's some in the Nidana Samyutta, yeah. So all of these are likely to be Sarvastivadin-type schools, okay? Now, Sanskrit fragments of the Madhura Sutra, also Sarvastivadin, however, probably. However, do not use the school Bodhisattva in a context where the Buddha refers to his pre-awakening experiences, while the corresponding Pali passage does employ the term. This suggests the absence of Bodhisattva in some contexts to be a peculiarity of some reciter traditions, perhaps more particularly of the Sarvastivada tradition. Now that's actually quite an interesting little remark here, because with a lot of these sutras, for one reason or another, it's fairly well established. Because you see, you get all these fragments, and it's very difficult to work out where they fit or what they belong to, and especially what school they belong to. And that makes a big difference. You know, you might think it doesn't really matter, who cares what school it comes from, it just says the same thing anyway. But it makes a big difference for the editors. For example, if you have a fragment of a sutra you think is from the Sanskrit, the Sarvastivadin Mahaparinibbana Sutta, then that means that you can go to the Tibetan canon, where you have a translation of the Sarvastivadin Mahaparinibbana Sutra, and you can compare that and use that for editing and correcting your Sanskrit text. Okay, so this is one of the reasons why these things are useful to know. A suggestion here, perhaps, because it seems that the Majjhima Agama does not use the term Bodhisattva, so perhaps the exclusion of it is a peculiarity of the Sarvastivada tradition. If that's so, and perhaps meaning the Sarvastivada in the narrow sense of the term, as in just the Sarvastivadin school and not the Sarvastivadin group or cluster of schools, then that might be useful for distinguishing the differences between, say, Sarvastivada and Mula Sarvastivada and so on and so forth. But that's only a suggestion so far.
Which one
school
that reified the Buddha?
Lokuttaravada.
Yeah,
the Mahasanghika branch. So, Nim Chao, however, concludes that the Theravada compilers introduced the term Bodhisattva into their Pitikas and gave the special meaning of the Buddha before his enlightenment, and thus discarded any other meanings attributed to it by the Mahayanists. So Tigmin Chao suggesting that this was the implication here. Because it sounds a little bit disparaging when it says, you know, I was only an unenlightened Bodhisattva, right? It sounds a bit like he's kind of there having a bit of a go at the poor old Bodhisattva. So this is what Tigmin Chao is suggesting. This suggestion, according to Venerable Analia, might not fully take into account the fact that the Theravada concept of a Bodhisattva developed along lines not too different from the Mahayana, which makes it less probable that the Theravada reciters would have felt a pressing need to invest this term with the unique meaning of the Buddha before his awakening. And I think it's a very pertinent point, and I think the difference in the stress on the Bodhisattva is far overemphasized in modern studies. And in fact, the ancient Theravada in Sri Lanka also gave a major role to the Bodhisattva in their ideas. Endo blah blah blah. In his detailed study of the Bodhisattva concept of the Pali text draws attention to Theragata commentary, which in addition to the Maha Bodhisattva, also speaks of the Pacheka Bodhisattva, okay, one who's on the way to becoming a Pacheka Buddha, and a Savaka Bodhisattva. Okay? So someone who's a disciple who's on his way to getting enlightened. Thus, in the developed Theravada tradition, the concept of a Bodhisattva also went beyond the special meaning of the Buddha before his enlightenment. In fact, in modern-day Sri Lanka, some of the most highly respected and influential monks, like the late Balangoda Ananda Maitreya, or Nawena Aryadhamma, who's the head of the Nawena Monastery and the head of the, I think, Manya Nikaya, forest tradition, are well-known having pledged them, and he's a Tipitaka diary, he's memorized the whole Tipitaka. Well known for having pledged themselves to follow the Bodhisattva path, which shows that the influence of the Bodhisattva ideal is not confined to the Mahayana traditions. And of course, that's only a little bit of evidence. Of course, it's very well known, and there's Sri Lankan artworks and all kinds of things to show how very powerful the idea of the Bodhisattva was throughout the Buddhist world. Not just in supposedly Mahayana countries. In fact, Xuanzang refers to all of these Mahayana. He regularly refers to Mahayana Theravadins. It's one of his basic categories of school. And in this monastery, there was 600 Mahayana Theravadins living. And he didn't seem to think that there was any difference between the two.
Of course, I always thought it was a good word.
Bodhisattva?
Yeah.
In what sense?
Well, doesn't it sort of stand for compassion and all that nice stuff?
Compassion and all the nice stuff? Yeah, but it depends how it gets used, you know. Like, for example, saying just today that I was speaking to Venerable Thich Quang Bao one time, and he was saying, oh, if you're an abbot, you have to be a real bodhisattva.
And this
horripilation causing kind of aspect of it. You know, as soon as you say you've got to be a bodhisattva to do that, means you've got to endure a lot of suffering, and you know, you're better off cutting your own arms off or something like that.
No.
That's what bodhisattvas have to do.
Okay.
All these kinds of things.
Just because you have that story about know you go first, know you go first.
Hmm. Well, the Thai forest tradition is well known for being founded on the rejection of the bodhisattva path. And this
really?
Is in the Ajahn Mun's biography, where he was sort of reached a certain level in his practice and then couldn't get any further, and then he recollected his past lives and realized he'd made a vow to be a bodhisattva. And then he had to relinquish his vow to be a bodhisattva before he could continue to become an arahant. And then he found out that his teacher, Ajahn Sao, also had made the same vow. So he had to gradually convince Ajahn Sao to relinquish his
vow. And then his ex-wife who was reborn in some heaven was unhappy and...
I can't remember all the details.
Huh? She's a bodhisattva and they vowed together.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
So in order to be enlightened, he had to forego being a bodhisattva?
Yep. That's what they say.
You amaze me. I never would have thought that.
It's in Ajahn Mun's biography.
It's a discussion.
Yeah. Well, Tim, have you read Ajahn Mun's biography?
No.
Oh, you'd like it. It's full of great stories. Yeah.
Is that
here, Mother? Oh, yeah. We've got dozens of copies.
We've also got Ajahn Sao.
We do, yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, in a sense, you know, it's just like as an ethical ideal, it's just like encouraging compassion and self-sacrifice and so on. So that's one level. But then the level at which it's... Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, it's certainly interesting to see the different way it's presented in the early suttas as opposed to the later developments. All right. So, it occurred to me, yannunaha, suppose, dvidha katwa, having cut in two, literally having cut in two, vitake vihareya, I should abide continually, so this kind of repetition, dvidha katwa, I should abide constantly or continually dividing my thoughts into two or analysing my thoughts into two classes. So again, this is very characteristic of this presentation of the Bodhisattva before his enlightenment, is he was always experimenting, he was trying things out. He's not following a pre-programmed course of spiritual development. He's just saying, okay, well, why don't I just try doing this? And obviously this doesn't give us particularly any context, but this must have been at a certain stage of development of his practice, where he's become interested in the workings of thought and trying to analyze that. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will and thoughts of cruelty, and I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will and thoughts of non-cruelty. So these three kinds of wrong thoughts and three kinds of right thoughts, of course, pertaining to the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right thought or right intention, samasankappa. So here, notice that sankappa and vitaka can be used as synonyms. So the wrong thoughts, karma vitaka, vyapada vitaka, vihinsa vitaka. And then on the other, bhaga, the other side, Kamma vitaka, abhyapada vitaka, avihinsa vitaka. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. I understood that this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nirvana. Okay. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. Okay, so of course this is, again, very characteristic of the early suttas. And I wonder whether this has anything to do with this motif of the Bodhisattva again, because we're told that the Arahant supposedly practices for their own benefit, okay, the Attabhyapat, for overcoming the affliction for oneself, but not for overcoming the affliction for another. This is what we're told. Whereas this is very, very characteristic of the early suttas, is it doesn't make that kind of hard and fast distinction. It speaks of the benefit for oneself, the benefit for others, and then the benefit for both. So moving from the obvious, the obvious thing we look out for our own benefit, the less obvious is we look out for others' benefits, and the even less obvious still is when we realize that actually the benefit for us and the benefit for others is not really different. So it's moving towards a synthesis of those things. And that's very, very characteristic of the early suttas. Yeah, similar. No, find that kind of thing many times. And when I consider this obstructs wisdom. Banya nirodhiko. Okay? It's a cesa of wisdom. Vigahata bakhiko. It's on the side, on the pakha. Pakha is used of like a political party. It's on the side of vigahata, hassles. Anibana sangvataniko, not leading, sangvatanika, to nibbana. Reflecting thus, then it ceased, abhatangachati. Okay? Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it. Okay? And the same, of course, for the.
What was the way for it reflecting that it dissolved?
Okay. Patisanchikkhato. Patisanchikkhati is this one of the very many words in Pali meaning to reflect or to think about or something. Abhatang gacchati. This phrase is used similar to the phrase is used, for example, when the sun is setting. Atangato. Yeah? As I abided thus, and similarly a thought with a thought of cruelty and a thought of ill will and a thought of cruelty. Okay. Now then the Pali then goes on to say Yanyadeva bhikkave bhikkhu bahulam anuvitakketi anuvichareti tathātathā nati hoti cetaso. Whatever a bhikkhu or bhikkhuni bahulam anuvitakketi, much, bahula, very much, constantly, anuvitakketi, thinking along. So notice the anu here, I mentioned this in the discussion of Satipatthana, is the anuvitakketi. Vitakedi means to think about, anuvitakedi, keep on thinking. Okay, so this is the meaning of it, it's becoming clear here. Yeah, one keeps on going, anuvichareti, keep on thinking a lot, and it keeps on going. Then, that way, the mind is led. Okay, the nati is the inclination, the leading of the mind. So Natasha's laughing, what are you laughing about?
Just talking about the frequency of thinking, and then you said the word nutty, and it sounded like nutty, and I was just reflect on how true it is,
Yes, right.
Thinking process really gets going.
How nutty we become. Amazing how the Buddha could have done such kind of cross-linguistic tons in there.
Strap a cord.
And again, this being like a key thing for modern ideas of cognitive behaviour. And we know that there's a physical correlate of that, is that in the brain, when you think in a certain way, you tend to encourage the growth of the connections in the synapses in your brain. And so that actually makes it easier for the brain impulses to go in that direction. And you can send them in a different way if you want, but because the synapses haven't been grown in that way, then it's harder for the messages to flow in that direction. And so, but if you keep on redirecting your mind in a particular way, gradually the connections will grow and the other connections will decay. And so over a period of time you can actually train your mind to move in different ways. I think that for me that's actually quite a useful aspect of that kind of brain-mind correlation, because it shows you just can't do it straight away, and it's not there's no problem. If you can't just stop thinking about something straight away, it's actually quite normal. It takes time and it takes continual training. There's nothing wrong with that.
Well,
the positive side is that when you do develop the positive thinking as well, that that also has its sticky. It's got an energy to it. So this is good. Okay, so whatever bhikkhu, if he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual desire, he's abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of sensual desire. If he thinks and ponders upon thoughts of ill will or thoughts of cruelty, he's abandoned the thoughts of non-cruelty to cultivate the thought of cruelty, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of cruelty. Just as in the last month of the rainy season in the autumn when the crops thicken, a cowherd would guard his cows by constantly tapping and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because he sees that he could be flogged, imprisoned, fined, or blamed if he let them stray into the crops. So too I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation, and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation, the aspect of cleansing. So this is the simile, of course, typically the Buddha using very homely, everyday similes. Now,
Just on that idea of the positive thought, in yoga they have a word called sankalpa.
Mm-hmm.
So when you meditate, you form sankalpa in your mind.
Yep.
A vision of, you know, positive vision of the future.
Uh-huh.
And then that, the story is that if you do this every day,
Does it always come true?
Not the Japanese.
Yeah, well, it can sometimes. Some, that's the same word as we're dealing with here. In Pali, it's sankappa. The same word as sankalpa.
Yeah, that's why I thought you might know
it. Yeah, it's the same idea. Whether it's always going to come true.
What is the translation of sankappa?
Sometimes they're translated as thought, sometimes as intention.
Right, yeah.
Sometimes as, like, wish or aspiration. Yeah, it seems to sort of go in between those meanings. Ajahn Sumedho in the Eightfold Path translates it as right attitude. But I think that's a bit passive. Sankalpa is a bit more, like you're saying, it's like a creative force. Yeah, it's a creative force in the mind.
Yeah, so for instance, if you're in ill health,
you form
a sankalpa of yourself running on the beach.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're talking about here, is that kind of right thought. I mean, I'm just cautious about sort of reifying that, and this is very typical, and people then think that you know, it's going to work all the time. Well, of course, it doesn't work all the time. It works sometimes. But it's not quite that simple. You know, I'm reminded, of course, of our lovely lady, whose name escapes me at the moment, who's running the Sage Cafe in Bundanoon. And she, her business philosophy was like, you know, may the abundance of the world overflow in my general direction. And she used to sort of teach about these kind of new age kind of ideas and so on. And then she went broke. So doesn't always work.
But what works is the purification of the mind.
Absolutely.
That's what works. That's not necessarily a material manifestation.
Exactly, yeah, yeah.
Like the Japanese with the
power button. Yeah, well, that's a good story. Maybe another time. Another time, that's a good story.
And it sets people up for failure, too. You
know,
if you take
a
positive approach and then you don't
kill
yourself from cancer,
it's like, oh, we didn't do it well. But you have to maintain the positivity.
Oh, definitely.
That's the most important. There's no point being negative.
No, of course.
More likely to bring negative results.
Of course. But contentment with whatever unfolds. Is a positive thought.
And I think that's one I think quite valid criticism made sometimes of New Age therapies, that they put too much emphasis on that, which can, you know, when it doesn't work. You know, and again, Buddhism has a very realistic approach. Well, sometimes you do that stuff and it works, sometimes it doesn't, you know. And you can sort of really get down on yourself if you think you've done something wrong. So
it's hard maybe to understand exactly the reason why it works sometimes and it doesn't work.
Right.
And you know, you just take, well, for some reason, it does seem to work sometimes.
Yep, and ultimately you don't really know
why
it does.
So maybe you can.
Well, just to sort of say one more thing about that, the reason it works or it doesn't work really depends on causes and conditions, which is at the heart of the Buddha's teaching.
Right.
It does depend on causes and conditions. And that saying that
immediately distinguishes new way thinking from Buddhism, because new way thinking doesn't really talk about causes and conditions in the way that Buddhism does. You know, that it really depends on the conditions, the karma conditions.
Yeah. Don't they talk about conditions in that way? I don't know.
I know. I haven't read anything about karma conditions.
No? Yeah. Okay. So, just as a textual point, the sequence here of the presentation of the simile and the about this bit about much thinking is slightly different in the two versions. In the Pali version, it gives the bit about where are we now? As I'm abiding, then the thoughts of sensual desire and so on. The bad thoughts arose in me, and then I abandoned them. And then it gives the much thinking, and then the simile, paragraph 6 and 7, and then the positive side. Then it goes on, and that sequence is slightly different in the Chinese version. But anyway, without going into the details of that, there's a little bit of a difference there. Analio thinks that the Chinese version is a bit more plausible in that case. Whether that's the case or not. Okay, so paragraph 8. Okay. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of renunciation has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, others' affliction, or the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause difficulties, and leads to nibbana. Okay? So here's the Amihingsa. It's a Panya Wudhiko. Before we had Panya Nirodhiko, the obstacle, or literally, more literally, the ceaser of wisdom. And here's the Panya Wudhiko, is the maturer, literally the ager or the maturer of wisdom. Panya Wudhiko.
Why?
Like a good claret, exactly. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a day and night, I see nothing to fear from it. Okay, Ratin Jepi Nang Bhikkhave Anuvitakkeyang Anuvicharyang. Never tato nidanang, and notice this connection, tato nidanang, with the Madhubindika Sutta, also using the same, exactly the same phrase, tato nidanang, from that source, bhayang samanupasami. For all day, and again notice the Pali idiom, starts out with the night, then goes to the day, diva being actually the same etymology as the word day, literally the basic root of it meaning bright, and then ratin divang, day and night. And again, like we saw with the benefits for myself, for others, and for both, we see that movement towards synthesis. And again here, the movement towards synthesis for night and day and night and day. Yeah? Very characteristic of the way of thinking in the suttas. Okay. But, apichiko me, but if I was too long, ati jirang, ati is excessive, over the top, Chirang, long time, anivitakkayato, anivicharayato, thinking and pondering, kayo kilameya, the body will become stressed out. Okay, so this is the same word as we find in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, atta kilamatanu yoga, self-mortification, so the body will become wearied. Kaye kilante, when the body is wearied, chittang uhanyeya. So this phrase here is in a locative case, and this is known as a locative absolute. Kaye kilante, when the body is tired, chittang uhanyeya, then the mind is...
Just gives the expression about the word itself.
Exactly, yeah, you don't need to translate. It's just uhanyeya. Uhanyeya. Yeah, so that's what that one means. And Bodhi translates as strained. Uhate. Chitte. Ara chittang samadhim hati. The mind is far, ara, from samadhi. It's the ablative case, samadhim ha. And it's just far from samadhi. Then, I, because settled the mind, ajhaptameva, right there inside, sat it down, sannisademi, ekodin karomi samadahami, made it one and concentrated. What is the reason? Thinking, ma me chittang uhanyiti. Okay? And here the ma expressing prohibition. May my mind not be stressed out. Okay? And the same for the other kinds of right thoughts. that okay. Now then, here introducing the Pali version, introduces again the motif of frequently thinking and pondering upon something, as I mentioned before, the slight variation in the sequence with this and the Chinese version. And then the reverse of the simile, just as in the last month of the hot season when all the crops have been brought inside the villages. Okay? Gimhana and Bachime Mase, the hot season, the Gimhana, Bachime, the last month. Okay. The crops have been brought inside the villages. A cowherd would guard his cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since he needs only to be mindful that the cows are there. Tasa rukamulasa wa abho kasagatasa wa sati karaniyameva hoti. There are the cows. Only has to be mindful. Eta galo. These are cows. Literally, it says only needs to be mindful. These are the cows. So this, in the same way, you just have to be mindful. These are dhammas. Okay? So that's again very nice that...
Isn't that another... Wasn't there another sutta where he talked about that we did a part from song where he talked about being a cowherd and watching the cows?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah. It's a lot.
Yeah,
it's very similar.
Yeah,
the whole thing about sati and the different...
Yeah.
Yeah,
gotcha. Yeah, it's quite a few, it's a classic image.
Classic image.
Yeah, and very nice, that difference between constantly looking after the cows and poking them and prodding them and getting them to go on the right way, and then just sort of saying, okay, that's all right, you can go now. All the crops have been taken in, you can't damage anything. I've just got to keep my eye on you.
And today you can say, check your oil in your car.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so I might just introduce here. So now it then goes on to, tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled, my mind concentrated and unified.
Oh, that is a gorgeous
sentence. Isn't it? Arradhang ko paname bhikkhave viryang ahosi asalina. My energy was roused up and unflagging, tireless. Upapita sati asamutta. Mindfulness was established and unconfused. The body was tranquil and undisturbed. Mind was concentrated and one-pointed. Okay? So, of course, this leading up to the four jhanas. So here we have this development of, first of all, learning to understand your thoughts, good thoughts and bad thoughts, trying to overcome and use your energy and so on to get rid of the bad thoughts and cultivate the good thoughts, and as the good thoughts become more prevalent and then constant, you can maintain them much more easily, but then you need to seek also for peace of mind inside, so you move from those good thoughts towards letting go of thoughts altogether and leading to samadhi in the mind. And this process is of course the whole field of meditation, isn't it? That very much of what we'd spend our time doing when we're meditating is dealing exactly with these things in exactly this way. And I'm just going to read here another sutta which discusses the same kind of process in a slightly different way. And this is a very interesting sutta from the Anguttara Nikaya, the threes of the Anguttara. Just trying to find the Pali. Okay. There are, O monks, Anant, gross impurities in gold, such as earth and sand, gravel and grit. Okay, so this is a jata rupasa, is of the gold. Or larika, coarse. No, here's coarse, upakilesa. So here's showing one of the reasons, the means of upakilesa in a down to earth sense. We use it in a mental sense, but he's showing exactly what they are. Earth, sand, gravel and grit. Now the goldsmith or his apprentice, first pours the gold into a trough and washes it, cleans it and rinses it thoroughly. When he's done this, there still remain moderate impurities in the gold, such as fine grit and coarse sand. So this is the majima sahagata upakilesa. Okay? Medium sahagata upakilesa. Sukuma sakara. Like the fine sand. Then the goldsmith or apprentice washes, rinses and cleans it again. When he does this, there still remains minute impurities in the gold, such as fine sand and black dust. Okay? So here we are, the jata rupasa, sukuma sahagata upakilesa, little sukuma, refined defilements. Okay? Now then they repeat the washing, and thereafter only the gold dust remains. He now pours the gold into a melting pot, and smelts it and melts it together. But he does not yet take it out from the vessel, as the dross has not yet been entirely removed. So he puts it in the musayam, into the vessel. Okay. Dross is not entirely removed. It's got a note here. Okay. So the Bhikkhu Bodhi comments here that the Pali is not entirely clear, and so he's done a fairly free rendering of the Pali. The sense is clear enough, but the exact meaning of the Pali is not very clear. This is giving you some fair bit of detail into ancient Indian gold smithing techniques here.
What is dross and
dross is just
impurity?
Yeah, dross is just the stuff which comes off it when you boil the gold.
Okay.
Yeah. What do they call it? Just like slag. And the gold is not been entirely removed, and it's not yet mudu, and it's not kamaniyam, so it's not soft mudu, and it's not kamaniyam, it's not workable. Nachapabhasaram, it's not radiant, okay? So it's not the radiant gold, and it's not, it is still brittle, babangu, okay? And it's not rightly usable for it to be worked, kamaya. Interesting to see this, the way that this language is used. You know, very, very similar language you find in the meditation context is used very directly. It's one of the interesting things about this particular suttas. But the time comes when the goldsmith or his apprentice repeats the melting thoroughly so that the flaws are entirely removed. Okay? And then the gold is now quite pliant, quite soft, mudu, workable and radiant, and it's not brittle, and it's right, and it lends itself to working. Whatever ornament the goldsmith now wishes to make of it, be it a diadem. What's a diadem?
Thing on my head.
Yes, so like a circlet.
Tiara thing.
Yeah. Earrings, a necklace or a golden chain, the gold can now be used for that purpose. Tas anjasa atang anubhoti. For that purpose, or Suvarna Malaya, golden mala.
Okay. That's also in that sutta about the man who stayed with in the pot was out,
mm-hmm.
and then the gold is likened to equanimity.
Yeah, very similar. Yeah.
What sutta was that your question from?
That's the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, Majjhima 140, I believe.
One of gold from the Anguttara Nikaya. That
this one we're on now is Anguttara 3.100.
And the other one was 140 exposition of the elements.
So, in the same way, with a monk devoted to or nun, devoted to the training of the higher mind, there are in him or her gross impurities, namely bad conduct of body, speech and mind. So I have to include the bhikkhunis in this bit because they've got gross impurities such as bad conduct of body, speech and mind, right? It's pathetic, isn't it? Everyone, that's just too obvious. They know what I'm doing anyway. Okay, such conduct, an earnest, capable monk or nun abandons, dispels, eliminates and abolishes. So if it's a bhikkhu, adhichittamani yutasa, okay? Intent or devoted to the higher mind, okay? Or the coarse defilements, in the same words found here, olarika upakilesa, olarika upakilesa, kaya ducharitang, vachi ducharitang, mano ducharitang. Okay, so this is the transgressions by means of body, speech, and mind, actually breaking your sila. Okay, so that's the first thing. Abandon these. Tasting Bahine, having abandoned these, Tasting Bhyantikas, having made an end of them, they're still, for a monk, intent upon the higher mind, middling defilements such as sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. Okay, so again, the same phrasing, the Majjhima Sahagita, Sahagata Pakilesa. And, of course, being the three kinds of wrong thought we've been dealing with in the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta. Then for an earnest, capable monk abandons, dispels, eliminates, and abolishes them. So a bhikkhu who is dabba jatiko, competent. Dabba jatiko, not to do with jhana.
No,
it's dabba is a capable. Jatiko means having the nature of being. Dabba Jataka. Yeah, yeah. When it's used as a suffix like that, it means a competently natured person, but we just translate it as being a competent. Something like that. Then, again, it continues, then there's the Sukuma Sahagata Upakilesa, the refined defilements. And this is where it gets interesting, is the Nyati Vitako, Janapada Vitako, Anavanyati Pati Sangyutto Vitako. So Nyati Vitako, meaning thoughts about your family.
These are the refined defilements.
These are the refined defilements. So you got rid of your transgressions of body, speech and mind, got rid of your thoughts of sensual desire, ill will and cruelty, and now you're sitting there worrying about your family and thinking about them. Quite realistic, isn't it? Not anything, it's not anything unwholesome, but it's just distracting to your meditation. Janapada vitako. Janapada is your country. Okay? So thinking about politics maybe? Maybe you're thinking of concern for people around you or in the region? Community, yeah.
Sheep?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, absolutely. You're sitting there thinking about, is there going to be rain this year? Are the crops going to grow? No, absolutely, why not? Anavanyati. Now, this one is as difficult to interpret as it seems. Anavanyati. Patisangyuto. Patisangyuto means connected with. Ava seems to mean down. Nyati probably means knowing down. Avanyati means probably looking down upon. And an is a negative prefix. Connected with not being looked down upon. Okay? That's what I reckon it probably means. And it's translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi as his reputation. Okay? So, not entirely clear. I'm not sure that this word appears elsewhere. But that's probably what it means, is thinking of
how I was perceived.
Yeah, you know, perhaps even like, you know, maybe even you've had conversations with people during the day and then you sort of go away and then you're kind of worried about, oh, how did I come across in that, or did that go okay, or, you know, I hope I didn't upset that person or something like that, you know. Okay, so then you abandon all of those thoughts. Okay. Tasmin pahine, tasmin vyantikate, having abandoned and got rid of them, ataparam, still remaining, is the dhamma vitakka vasissati, the thoughts about dhamma. Okay. This is the dhamma vitakka. So hoti samadhi, that samadhi, na ceva santo, is not peaceful, na panito, is not refined, na pati pati, sadhaladho, is not attained to tranquility. Na eko di bhavadhigato, is not attained to one-pointedness. And again, this lovely compound here, sasankhara nigaiha varitagato. Okay? So, to break this compound up, sa is with, sankhara, sasankhara, sa is with in this case, sankhara meaning, probably in this case, meaning active. Nigaiha, meaning something like grabbing hold of or holding on to or something like that. And varita is constrained, okay? Gato meaning in a state of being, okay? State of being like that. So translated here, it is maintained by strenuous suppression of the defilements, okay?
They're the most difficult words we've done so far. A whole bunch of them.
Yeah, it's pretty. There's quite a big lot of them there, and see quite a few different readings here as well. Very similar readings, but again, not entirely sure how to break it up. But that's probably the meaning of it. Is like held in place by means. It's constrained into place. Yeah, by active effort, active pushing it into place. Yeah. And again, that's very, you know, we know what that means, don't we? Yeah? When you sort of get to, you know, meditating along, get to a bit of state of meditation, and you get to a degree of samadhi, a degree of concentration, but it's still, even though it's still pretty wholesome and pretty together and so on, but it's still not, and exactly as it's presented, that samadhi here is not yet peaceful and refined and tranquil, not completely unified, and still you're a bit nervous about it and you're having to sort of keep your mind on to the meditation and keep it focused and so on. And So this is very interesting because this is one of the clearest, if not perhaps the clearest place in the whole of the suttas where it actually talks about a kind of like in-between state of not being either just an ordinary state of the thinking, ordinary mind, nor of being a full state of jhana. And here, and the ambiguous nature of that, and again, I'll just continue on with the next paragraph here. It says, and it's held into place, vigorously constrained and held in place. So, bhikkhu, then that monk, there comes a time, a samaya, when that bhikkhu, the mind, ajhattam yeva, right down inside, he still settles and makes it one-pointed, which is, of course, the same kind of language we found in the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta. Here a little bit with the Samtapemi Samnisida Demi Eko Rinkaromi Samadahami. Same kind of language there to use to still settle and bring the mind to one-pointedness. And that samadhi is peaceful, refined, attained to tranquility, attained to one-pointedness, and is not actively held in place by restraint. It's not actively constrained into place. Something like that. And yasa yasa cha abhinya sachi karani yasa dhamma sachitang abhinina meti. Okay. And then whatever kind of dhamma you want to realize through direct knowledge, through abhinya, then you're capable. Sakhi bhabhatang. You're capable of witnessing that. The word sakhi here. Notice that you have this phrase sakhi. It's actually, although it doesn't quite look like it, it's actually the same as the word here, sachi. And the root of it is sa, one's own, aki, eyes. Okay? And this is the same word as we find in the third noble truth, sachikatabang. Okay? The third noble truth of Nibbana is sachikatabang. The literal meaning of it is can be seen with one's own eyes. Okay? And the word here is, you can see the dictionary definition, the sakhi is a witness, an eyewitness, sa'aki, someone who's seen something with one's own eyes. So if you're going to trial in a legal case and you call a sa'aki, sa'aki is someone who saw what happened with their own eyes. Okay. So
the third noble truth is the ceasing of suffering, isn't it?
Yep, and that's something that
you realize.
Yeah, and you realize, to be realized, to be seen with your own eyes. Yeah? So this is not the same, not quite the same thing here, but it's the same word is being used. Sati papunati, so he attains sati, satai, satiayatane. This is another slightly uncertain idiom here, but probably means whenever there is, whatever kind of realm or whatever domain that you want to realize that ability. So in other words, and then of course goes on to talk about the attainment of the various kinds of psychic powers and so on. So in other words, obviously by this description of meditation here is talking about jhanas and contrasting that samadhi which is peaceful and so on, sublime and one-pointed, with the previous kind where it says that samadhi is not peaceful and not sublime and so on and so forth. So this is one of the rare occasions where it refers to samadhi in a more general sense rather than just for jhanas. Okay, so you've got two uses of samadhi. One samadhi is not peaceful, not refined, not one-pointed, and then the next kind of samadhi is peaceful, is refined, is one-pointed. And so this is, we see that the unpeaceful samadhi is the, seeming to refer to that kind of state, probably similar to, kind of upachara kind of state, or pre-jhana kind of state, which we call upachara these days. And also just to remind you that, interesting, that's preceded by this idea of dhamma vitaka, that even thinking about the Dhamma is an obstacle to deep samadhi.
And that can sort of creep in, too,
can't
it?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, you can give yourself a bit of a Dhamma talk and hang on.
Mm.
You know, I mean...
Who's listening?
Yeah, well, you know, so it's something to be mindful of, but that is it's a more subtle sort of thing that you can think, oh, okay, Dhamma, I've related it. Just distracting yourself, another way of...
Yeah.
Not being present with just whatever is there.
Mm. But it's not, remember, it's not saying that that's always wrong.
No.
It's saying that there's a stage in meditation when you need to go beyond it. Yeah.
Mm.
And at other times it's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
So, interesting little sutta, that one. So back to the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta. So this is now 14 to 23, and so here, of course, it goes on to entering into the four jhanas and realizing the various kinds of direct knowledges. In this case, the three true knowledges, the te vidya, and okay, entering the first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, and then that mind state. And remember, we just look at the one in Anguttara with the mind, which is purified like the gold. And here's a chitte parisudhe, purified, bright, and angane. Vigat upakilese, same word, upakilesa, we found in the previous one. Mudubhute, made soft, just like the gold was made soft. Kammaniye, workable, just like the gold was made. So, exactly the same kinds of wordings using here.
Where's this in the translation?
This has been eluded from the translation. It's been left out of the translation.
But
just the text gives it more fully than the Bhikkhu Bhagavad
Gita. But that's so important. To refer back to the contents of the sutta, if it has those kinds of things which you're referring that are talked about in the sutta, and then you just abbreviate it, well, the abbreviation doesn't actually cover it.
No, this is referring back to what's found in the other sutta that I was just mentioning there.
Uh-huh. Whereabouts is this paragraph?
It only mentions the third true knowledge, it doesn't say the other two. Yeah,
no, it doesn't have this phrase in there.
So, but that's quite an important passage.
It is, but it's in many, many other suttas, so it's just abbreviated it and so on.
Pati is outraged.
Is that right? Right to Bhikkhu Bodhi. Suppose, because that in a wooded range there was a great low-lying marsh near which a large herd of deer lived. Then a man appeared desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage. And he closed off the safe and good path to be travelled joyfully, and he opened up a false path, and he put a decoy and set up a dummy so that the large herd of deer might later come upon calamity, disaster, and loss. Okay? And another man came desiring their good welfare and protection, and he reopened the safe and good path that led to the happiness, and he closed off the false path, and he removed the decoy and destroyed the dummy so that the large herd of deer might later come to growth, increase, and fulfillment. Okay? Okay, so then, because I have given this simile in order to convey a meaning, atta, vinyapanaya, so this is a causative form from vinyana, is to cause understanding or to bring understanding. And this is the meaning. The great low-lying marsh is a term for sensual pleasures. Mahantang ninnang palalanti. Okay, is of course is a term for sensual pleasures. A great sangha of deers, okay, maha miga sangha, this is a word for beings. The man desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage is a term for Mara, the evil one. Mara setan papi mato. The false path, kummaga. Okay, so notice the prefix here, kummaga. Ku is a fairly rare prefix used in Pali, but you have words like kupurisa or kapurisa, meaning it has a negative sense, but a bit stronger than the other negative words in Pali, meaning like a bad path. Not just like Micha Maga, which would be a wrong path. Kummaga means is the kind of the bad path or something. Is the eightfold wrong noble path. That is to say, wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong samadhi.
The deep. That's
pretty bad, yeah. The decoy is a term for delight and lust. Okacharo is a term for nanglas. And the dummy is a term for ignorance. Okacharika. Okay. Is a term for avidya. The man desiring their good welfare and protection is a term for the tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened. Fuso attakamo, wishing for the benefit. Hitakamo, wishing for their happiness. So notice here the word karma, normally meaning sensual pleasures, here just meaning wishing. And so this is the Buddha saying that he is one who's karma. Okay? He's attakama, yeah? And hitakama, wishing for the benefit. And the safe and good path to be travelled joyfully, hiti gamaniyo, joyfully travelled, this is the noble eightfold path. That is right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. So bhikkhus, the safe and good path has to be travelled joyfully has been reopened by me. The wrong path has been closed off, the decoy removed, and the dummy destroyed. What should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them, that I have done for you, bhikkhus. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Jayata bhikkhave ma pamadatta ma paccha vipatisari no ahuvatta ayang vo amaha kang anusasanante. So there are these roots of trees. Here are these empty huts. Jayata. It's just the verbal form of jhana. Do jhanas, bhikkhus. Ma pamadatta. Do not be negligent. Do not. Paccha, afterwards. Vipatisarino. So here, sarino is to remember it. Pati is the re, going back to it again. And vi is wrong. It's all badly, okay? So don't go back to it thinking about it badly. It's almost literally what it's saying. Don't be remorseful afterwards. This is our instruction to you. This is the anusasana. So very important to remember. This is the essence of the Buddha's teachings. The roots of trees, the empty huts. Go there and do the thing.
That's what you said to us before, Vivasa.
Absolutely. Here's the empty huts. Here's the roots of trees. Here's the room above the toilets.
Above the toilets. with the exhaust fan.
Go to your room.
Coming back to that part where he abbreviates.
Yep.
So, because the other formula, back in the sutta he quotes,
yep.
4.23.2,
yep.
It doesn't give what you say is there.
What do you mean?
Well, you said it has the, is it like the malleable, workable?
Yep.
Does it have that there?
Yep. 27? My mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability.
Okay.
Yeah?
And where's that in the sutta?
Right here. Here we are. Vigatupa kilese, parisuddhe, pariyodate, anangane,
vigatupa kilese. After the jhana formula or in the...
After the jhana formula. That phrase always comes after the fourth jhana.
So that's okay.
Yeah. It's all right? That's good.
Happy at last. Okay.
Yeah, that phrase always comes, it's like the culmination of the fourth jhana description, and then leading into the development of the direct powers.
When your mind is interpretable and malleable, then you're able to be able to direct it to psychic powers or know your past life.
Yep. Yeah. Okay.
The Pali word to see with your own two eyes.
Yeah.
Is there a different word for the English word understood?
Sachi.
Sati.
What do you mean?
Sati. It's like suffering in the first level to be understood.
Is that the word that you said is equivalent to, well, the English translation is to see and to witness it.
Yeah.
That's almost like suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to say to understand, or it was understood,
uh-huh.
That would be a different.
Yeah. This one specifically emphasizes that aspect of direct personal experience. So just to note a variation in Chinese, and I don't know, Mallow is quite interesting discussion here. Okay, a difference in relation to the presentation of that movement between the pre-jhana development and going into the jhanas is that the Chinese proceed directly from leaving behind wholesome thoughts to the attainment of the second jhana, while the Pali version includes the first jhana in its account. Okay, so the Chinese version says you get rid of the wholesome thoughts and then you get into second jhana. A similar absence of the first jhana can be found in another Pali discourse, the Danta Bhumi Sutta, which proceeds directly from overcoming thoughts to getting into the second jhana. Now that's in the Pali version. However, the reverse situation, because in that case the Chinese version does mention the first jhana. So in one case the Chinese has just got from before, you know, abandoning thoughts and then getting into second jhana, and the Pali has first jhana and then second jhana, and then the other version it's the other way around. The Pali skips first jhana and the Chinese has it. So what's going on? An evaluation of these two passages requires an examination of the nature of the first jhana in order to ascertain whether leaving behind wholesome thoughts could directly lead to entering the second jhana without any need to develop the first jhana. Vitakka, the mental factor whose precedent is characteristic of the first jhana, is etymologically related to takka, which stands for thought and logical reasoning. This etymological relation suggests that conceptual thought continues during the first stage of absorption. And it gives a few references here, including Rod Bucknell and some other people. If this should indeed be the case, then the Chinese parallel to the Dvaidha Vitakka Sutta would present a meaningful presentation. Here Venerable Nalu is using a typical Pali construction of having a coordinating a verb with its noun form, present a presentation, which is very idiomatic in Pali but not very idiomatic in English, would present a presentation by proceeding from leaving behind wholesome thoughts directly to the attainment of the second jhana. Yet, okay? So he's saying, well, that's one way of looking at it. First jhana's got vitakka, so since the suttas are talking about getting rid of vitakka and going to the second jhana, it makes sense from one way of looking at it. Yet, the problem with such interpretation is that the discourses consistently treat the first jhana as a deep state of concentration. The Upikilesa Sutta and its Madhyamagama parallel record that the Buddha, during his time as a Bodhisattva, had considerable difficulties in overcoming a whole host of mental obstructions before being able to attain the first jhana. The same Upikilesa Sutta reports that Anuruddha and a group of monks experienced similar difficulties, while another discourse describes that the Buddha had to assist Mahamoggallana to help him to attain the first jhana. It's noteworthy that Anuruddha and Mahamoggallana, who according to the list of eminent disciples of the Anguttara Nikaya excelled other disciples due to their concentrative attainments, would have needed the Buddha's personal intervention to obtain the first jhana. This suggests that the first jhana requires a considerable amount of meditation practice, even in the case of gifted practitioners, from which it would follow that the first jhana already constitutes a deep level of concentration. Same impression can be reached from the Sandaka Sutta, which indicates that to attain the first jhana is to reach a superbly extraordinary state, okay, which is an ularang visesam. And another discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya and its Majjhima Agama counterpart proclaim that by entering the first jhana one goes beyond Mara's reach. One who enters the first jhana is no longer able to speak. According to a discourse in the Anguttara Nikaya and its Majjhima Agama counterpart, external sound is a disturbance to the first jhana, literally called a thorn, which indicates that hearing also does not occur during jhana. These qualifications would not apply if the first jhana were merely a state of calm mental reflection. They rather support an understanding of the first jhana as a deeply absorbed state of mind beyond mere reflection and conceptual thought. Hence, in the context of jhana attainment, vitakka does not appear to refer to conceptual thought proper, but rather to initial application of the mind. To just translate vitakka as initial mental application finds support in the Mahachatarisaka Sutta, which includes application of the mind, chetaso abhinirupana, in a list of synonyms for right thought along with vitakka. So this is indicating that even within the suttas themselves, vitakka is used in a range of meanings, from ordinary thought up to that more refined idea of chetaso abhinirupana, application of the mind. Such a applying of the mind to the object of meditation is a mental activity that can take place at a non-verbal level. A similar understanding of the nature of vitakka's effect of the first jhana can also be derived from the way the Chinese translators rendered this factor. In each of the four Chinese agamas, vitakka is rendered by a Chinese character whose meaning is to awaken, covering also the sense of being awake or being aware. So this is
Yojie.
Okay?
Have something?
And different synonyms for that is Bodhi, Buddhi, Buddhi, Abhisambodha, Prajna, Vid, realizing, and Vitakka. So all of those may have the meaning of being aware. By using this particular character for rendering Vitakka as a jhana factor, the early Chinese translators appear to have expressed their understanding of its practical implications in this particular context, indicating that the range of meaning of vitakka cannot be confined to conceptual thought. This understanding can be clearly seen in the Chinese parallel to the Dvaidha Vitakka Sutta, where the translator used this particular Chinese character when rendering vitakka as a jhana factor, while he used a different Chinese character for other occurrences of vitaka in the same discourse, such as when the question at stake is wholesome or unwholesome thought. The use of two different Chinese characters indicates that the... So, wholesome, unwholesome thought done here is dreya, and then nian. Nian is also used for satiya, but can mean thought as well as nian for. It's wholesome. The use of two different kinds of sound characters indicate that translators were well aware of the difference between these two types of vitaka and endeavoured to render them in such a way that they would not be confused with each other. And I think that's a very good point. And just to reinforce that, the use of vitaka, especially in the jhana formulas, is absolutely standard throughout the entire Buddhist tradition. So we were speaking with one of the scholars at the AABS the other day. He's sort of doing his PhD into jhanas, and he's sort of trying to research the whole everywhere and trying to get some variations on the jhana formulas to try to get some, you know, but it's actually rendered with such incredible consistency that there's almost no variations in the terminology whatsoever in all of the Sanskrit and other versions, so we can be very confident that the Chinese translators were in fact rendering the word vitaka in that context. They weren't rendering any other word. Based on this understanding of the nature of vitaka as a jhana factor, it becomes clear that to simply leave behind the conceptual type of vitaka would not suffice for straightaway entering the second jhana without developing the first jhana. In view of this, the Pali version of the Dvaidha Vitaka Sutta and the Chinese parallel to the Danta Bhumi Sutta, both of which do take the first jhana into account, appear to have preserved a more complete account of the mental development that takes place at this point. So, arguing against the previous suggestion that the omission of first jhana was deliberate, he's now saying it doesn't seem to quite make sense. Then he proposes another thesis. The omission of the first jhana in the Chinese parallel to the Dvaita Vitaka Sutta and the Pali version of the Danta Bhumi Sutta could easily have happened during oral recitation, but the circumstance that leaving behind of vitaka has already been mentioned may have misled the reciters to continue with the standard formulation of the second jhana, which mentions such leaving behind of vitaka, thereby unintentionally omitting to recite the first jhana. And it gives an example down here from the Pali. You can actually illustrate it if you're reciting. Mātadhammu pasanjitam vitakam vitake siti so vitaka vichara nam bhupasama. Now you can see how the vitaka vichara follows on from the vitaka here, and that so naturally would invite the reciter to put it that way, even though the first jhana formula perhaps was intended. It's found in the Chinese version. A related case can be found in one of the Pali editions of the Sangharava Sutta, which describes how the Buddha reached awakening. During this description, however, this particular edition of the Sangharava Sutta does not mention the fourth jhana, so that on sticking to this particular reading, one would have to conclude that the Buddha did not develop the fourth jhana before attaining the three higher knowledges. Okay? And just as in the case... Sorry? Right, just as in the case of the omission of the first jhana discussed above, here too the omission of the fourth jhana makes little sense from a practical perspective and stands in contrast to numerous other passages in the Pali Nikayas and Chinese Agamas. As the other Pali editions do mention jhana, its omission in one edition must be a reciter's error or even a printing error in this particular Pali edition.
What about the
Jayanti
and Thai versions, what
do
they say?
No, he's got all the references here. Fourth jhana, Burmese, Siamese, blah, blah, blah.
They have the first jhana mentioned?
First jhana on this particular sutta? Yeah. I think in this case the editions are consistent. Yeah, I think. Which would imply that if it is a mistake, it would imply it's probably an old mistake.
That what you recited, that is that how the recitations go? What you did.
What do you mean, how they go?
Sound like?
Well, you didn't just recite. You didn't just read the thing. You did it.
Uh-huh.
Well, it sounded rather good. You could do it again.
Yes, it can be recited in many different ways.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Oh,
I'm not particularly worried. I'm not particularly worried about it. So
we've got perfume today from the flowers. Well, that's a nice
chanting sound. Okay.
Have all five.
That sounds good. Okay, so any more questions? Comments? elucidations, refutations.
Do you think that the idea of harm could be influenced by current Indian context? Say, such as Jainism with the Ahimsa. So with the thought, thought, what do you have? You have non-ill will, and then you have harmlessness. And so splitting the thought and then saying, well, this is not for my benefit, not for the other person's benefit. Kind of like on that Ahimsa kind of principle. Do you think? Do you think that there's a kind of, you know, that idea is so current within the Indian system that would have been something you would have thought about?
Oh, for sure, yeah. You know, definitely that would be one of the aspects that he picked up. And he virtually says that there's the sort of way he talks about his practices, and he says, you know, he was sort of stepping so mindfully he wouldn't hurt a little creature in the ground.
Worrying about the water,
disturbing
the insects in the ground.
Yeah, so for sure I think that's
definitely
the case.
So in terms of, yeah, like if you're having thoughts that are thoughts of cruelty, say for instance, or thoughts of sensual desire, for instance, what he's suggesting here is that you replace thoughts with thoughts of non-cruelty.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you just it's kind of hard to sort of say, don't think that.
Exactly. So it's like it's a gradual thing rather than just not thinking. Train your mind to think in the right direction and then gradually can drop them off.
Right. I guess there's no sense in being so hard
about it. Yeah. You just and I think it can be quite dangerous, you know, if you just try to force yourself to stop thinking and you haven't trained your mind or understood what your thoughts are about. Bashing them on the head all the time and just trying to not think, but it actually, you know, works according to this natural process.
What comes to mind is if you remember old video tapes, you push fast forward, once it's going fast forward, then you push rewind, because it stops and then kind of goes back.
And then it has to rewind itself, yeah.
So it kind of has this kind of like stumbling kind of process where it kind of stops and then rewinds.
That's true, yeah.
So it's kind of like redirecting your thoughts and you're fast forwarding, but now you need to the other direction. That kind of stumbling process that happens.
Yeah.
You know what's interesting is that this is in a way antithetical to the process of Jungian therapy, for example, where you take something like an ego thought. But I think this is true of an unwholesome thought that's associated with a strong set of emotions. And you actually follow it. You let it get big. You feel the feelings. You maybe even draw it or move it or move around it. And then through that process of truly allowing it in that relationship, it actually transforms itself. So you're not interrupting it and immediately going to a positive thought, but actually following the process. And I think the thought that I have in response to the sutta is that the Buddha isn't distinguishing between those kinds of unwholesome thoughts that aren't deeply rooted in emotions and those unwholesome thoughts that are. Because if they aren't, then I could see very easily being able to renounce it. If you see it, you see that it's suffering and you renounce. But, you know, honestly, sort of not only just for myself, but for many people who are struggling with that, just to say, renounce it and go to a positive thought just doesn't work. You need some other ways to work with the emotions underneath, because you go to a positive thought and immediately it drops. There's nothing for the positive thought to root into because the feelings underneath the negative thoughts haven't been acknowledged and followed through and heard or seen.
Sure, yeah.
So that's the one thing that comes to me about this.
Yeah. No, I think that's very true, and I think that's I think there's a very clear. I mean, it's not always obvious in practice, but at least theoretically, it's a clear difference between just kind of random thoughts, which may be just triggered by a mood or whatever, and something which is more of a kind of a deeply embedded structure in the mind, which needs to be overcome with some more understanding and so on. And I think that's very true. I think perhaps in the other suttas, like in the Vitaka Santana Sutta, which is the next one that talks more about different ways of approaching it, some of which are the more just replace one with the other, and then others are more kind of investigative and so on. So I think, yeah, sure, that there's, you know, and ultimately the aim is the same, of course, you know, by investigation, your aim still is to overcome the unwholesome, but you overcome it through understanding and assimilation and transformation rather than simply of letting it go, so... Yeah, but yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's very important. If you just kind of shoot the thoughts out of the sky all the time, then you don't understand them, and then you don't know why do they keep coming back into the sky. You know, you keep on, you know, it's like you've got the cow's field next door breeding up the blowflies, and you sort of can keep on trying to get the blowflies out of your house, but you don't know why do the blowflies keep coming here, you know? Well, you've got to clean up the cow dung if you want to stop the blowflies from coming.
I guess it's kind of like some of the kind of Vipassana teaching methods where they say, you know, you go there and have this big problem.
Hmm.
When I've heard, and then you talk about it, and then they say, oh, just note it, and then you keep going back, and you keep going back, and they say,
And it probably depends. And the problem is, it probably did work for the teacher.
Yeah.
This is the problem. And yeah, it maybe just doesn't work for everyone else. This is the problem.
I mean, of course, with some thoughts you can just have enough to bring it to an end. But when it's a strong force in the mind.
My axe in his head thought only came to once, and I am sorry about it, and I would have never done it. But it was just I was angry at that time.
But the thing is that if you, in that situation like I gave, that if you just, like, you want to put the axe in his head, and then you just, oh, I have this thought of putting this axe in his head, and that this thought keeps coming up, and then you just keep noting that all the time, and then it's kind of like, builds up to this, actually the axe going into the head. So that's the dangerous part with just the noting part. If you actually don't do something, try and work, or try and have some understanding to it rather than just kind of trying to cut it off, it doesn't always work. So sometimes doing that leads to the axe going in the head. I think, in those situations, learning to be your own friend, be a friend to yourself. And like with metta, you develop it for yourself first, but with the other Brahma Viharas, with compassion, you develop it for yourself first. So you have to be able to really have strong compassion for yourself before it moves to the next person.
Okay, so let's finish by paying respects.
Pannu bhagavato sāvaka saṅgho